You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel. Coming up this week in episode 313, loop pedals, discarded tents, and of course the Foo Fighters, looking back at Glastonbury 2017. We present Justine Greening's guide to job interviews. And we ask, what's the big deal about Radiohead? Yeah, what is it? It's all coming right up after the Waterboys and Glastonbury song.
There is a green hill far away, I'm going back there one fine day. Number 29 in the UK in 1993 for the Waterboys and Glastonbury song. Welcome to the podcast from the Parish Council. It's episode 313, which I figured out is a palindromic number.
It is.
I'm Terence Dackham, and who's this dancing with the architecture? Why, it's Juliet Harris.
That's always me. Hello, good morning / afternoon / evening, wherever you are, dear listeners.
Breaking news, you went along to the wonderfully named Warrior Square.
Yes, where I used to live for several years, happily.
To hear the man of the moment speak to his people.
Mm.
Yes.
Absolutely. So he's making a list. He's checking it twice. He's going to find out who's a closet Blairite. Santa Corpse is coming to town. Yes, Jeremy Corbyn came to St Leonard's Warrior Square in St Leonard's yesterday. We're recording this on Sunday, the 2nd of July. So Saturday, the 1st of July, he came and he stood on a stage that was not big enough and spoke. And I saw occasional portions of Mr. Corbyn's head, and he came to address a rally. It was organised on short notice, these things often are. There were probably at least, the square wasn't full, but I'd say there were hundreds of people, probably at least 1,000, I would say.
Interesting, because, sorry to interrupt you, but the Labour activists who were there were saying 4,000, 5,000 on Twitter.
I think that's an overestimation. I think there may have been a couple of thousand. It's difficult to tell when you're in the crowd.
It is, yeah.
Some of my friends were stood up towards the back of the stairs, a square up some steps, so they probably had a better view. But I would say, yeah, maybe a couple of thousand, but I don't think there were, you know, if there had been 5,000 people there, that square would have been full from
people
start.
People always overestimate these numbers.
Yeah, I think so. But it was well attended, I thought. Obviously, I went as a bit of a sceptic, but I thought, well, I'm interested what this man's got to say. He's the leader of the Labour Party and he's come to Hastings. And one thing that was interesting was I saw an awful lot of people I knew there. I mean, so many people that I knew, who were all lovely to see everyone. That concerned me because it did make me think how broad is Labour's appeal at the moment? And that's always been a concern to me. People saying, oh, isn't it nice to see everyone I know? And I felt like someone, in fact, I'd feel more comfortable if I held it to anybody I knew. And it was a whole new kind of group of people, mostly white and middle class, has to be said. Nice to see lots of people there with their children. Lots of people thought it important to take their children, which I think is great. Unfortunately, one of my friend's kid there managed to impale himself on the railing and take him away to hospital. Fortunately, he's all right. We've now learned. Vinny was stitched up by the NHS. So well done, NHS. But
he'll remember that day.
Well done, Vinny, who managed to do it 3 minutes into Jeremy Corbyn speaking. So my poor friend didn't actually get to see Jeremy Corbyn speak after all that. We spoke for about half an hour in the lead up to the tour. But anyway, so it was all, I found it to be quite white and middle class. A usual story as with your observation with the the photograph of Mr. Corbyn at Glastonbury pouring the pint of beer, and why was the only black face in high vis. For about 10 minutes, that was a similar situation at this rally, although I did complain about this to a friend of mine who then pointed out a mixed-race woman that walked past behind us. But it was very white, I thought, which, again, I always find to be a little bit disconcerting. He was very interesting. He was very measured. He did get a bit shouty at the end. He built to a bit of a climax, but he was pretty measured. He doesn't really, in a way I liked him because he didn't do the kind of call. He did do a bit of call and response, but he mostly did the kind of, he mostly just spoke. He mostly was a man talking rather than someone making a speech, which had its plus points in that he did sound very authentic and he sounded very reasonable. He said a lot of sensible things that I didn't disagree with. And I thought it was very good in that sense. But I did find my attention wandering a bit because it did feel like it went on for a long time. Parts of it I struggled to remember this morning.
My problem with Jeremy Corbyn is that I feel that I'm supposed to say this terrible man who would ruin the country. And then every time I hear him speak or see his policies, I'm kind of thinking, I kind of agree with that.
Yeah,
that's true. Absolutely. Rather a bit disturbing, really. Well, last week, of course, he was addressing a slightly bigger crowd than those that gathered at Warrior Square. And Jules, when I review Glastonbury from the comfort of my sofa, I have to acknowledge it has changed beyond recognition since my first visits in the 1980s and even since my last visit in 2002, that was the first year that the massive security fence was erected, and that also made a major contribution to safety.
I think that changed the culture as well.
It really has. I think it's led to Glastonbury becoming an increasingly sort of middle England, middle class attraction, almost as much a part of the summer season as tennis at Wimbledon and Royal Ascot when you look around the crowd. I will mention some of my highlights in a bit, but I'm going to start with a moan, which is, you know, out of character.
I wasn't expecting
it's a surprise. Firstly, why, oh why, oh why can't everyone gather up their rubbish and take it to a designated pickup point.
You're preaching to the converted here.
The pictures taken on Monday morning of fields and fields full of litter that, and I believe it required a team of 800 people to pick it up. Mm. It's a searing indictment of how uncivilised we are.
Yes.
And my second moan, possibly not universally shared, is about the BBC's television presenting team at Glastonbury. Mm. The patronising tone, the stating of the obvious, the almost gleeful, underprepared presentation, and the bubble that they inhabit makes them think that it's all about them. They kept saying, you know, what a great time they were having and where they'd been, and they were walking across here and they saw so and so. Instead of constantly struggling to find words to describe the atmosphere, just shut up and let us see, hear and feel the atmosphere for ourselves.
Absolutely, I agree. And actually, I don't, although I do watch a bit of Glastonbury on television, for me, the complete game changer, oh God, I hate that phrase. Anyway, the thing that makes stuff a lot easier as a Glastonbury viewer is that one can avoid just that because the BBC's online and iPlayer service
Keep forgetting this. Every year I forget this.
Yeah, it's so expanded that what I've been doing is hearing... I did watch a bit of stuff on telly. I watched some of the Sunday night coverage and the Sunday early evening, the tea time, the legend slot coverage, which I enjoyed Barry Gibbons, Sheik and co very much. But I find... people tell me what bands they're enjoying and I go and I look. You can look up by individual band now on BBC iPlayer, and I think he's up there for a month after Glastonbury, and you can pick individual sets. It was very telling to me, I thought, that I looked up who I enjoyed. Well, you know those Facebook memory things where it comes up and tells you what you've been doing, you know, what you've seen in Facebook previously on this day. Well, I noted that in 2014, the three bands that I enjoyed that year were the same three bands that I enjoyed this year. So I don't know what that says about. I said 3 years ago I'd really enjoyed Warpaint, Royal Blood and Haim. And this year we had Warpaint and Royal Blood and Haim on the television. So I don't know what that says about Glastonbury, all the number of bands that are available generally. We've discussed this and the potential reasons for this previously, I think. But my dad very much hated Royal Blood, which made me enjoy them even more, I think. I asked him we'll talk about Radiohead later on, but I asked him his verdict on Radiohead, and I said, did you enjoy them, laughing, knowing full well that he hates them? And he said, to be fair, they weren't as awful as Royal Blood. So high praise indeed from my dad. There were many reasons why he disliked Royal Blood. Some arbitrary and some not. He thought they were too loud. He disliked the fact that there were only two of them for some reason. And I pointed out that I was in a two-person band, and he said, well, exactly. Thanks, Dad. and also he disliked the fact that they had no bass player. And he just liked the fact the song seemed to go on for a very long time. And I said, oh, they're from Brighton, you know, desperately trying to clutch for, you know, kind of locality so that he might think they're a local band. And he went, well, they might as well go and live in Aberdeen because they can probably still be heard from there. So Dad, not a Royal Blood fan.
Clearly not. No.
My favourite discovery of the weekend, actually, and I do like the Glastonbury coverage of this. I always come across a band, which my whole family is. My mum fell very deeply in love with Tame Impala a year or two ago, who are great, to be fair. And I'd done a CD for her already, and I think she suddenly twigged in as to who it was. I very much enjoyed a singer type, and it wasn't really, I suppose, my sort of music, in that it was kind of... it was grown-up pop, I would say, really. And I found out she was Scandinavian, which didn't surprise me at all, actually, because it really was. She was called Sigrid. It's spelled S-I-G-R-I-D. She's Norwegian, and she's only 20. She looked about 12. She'd had a hit with a song called Don't Kill My Vibe, which she did at the end. But I thought she was great. She had a sort of a backing band, mostly people on synths, and there was a drummer, I think, and a woman that did some backing vocals with her. And I found myself of turning into my parents. She was well dressed. She had red trousers and a white t-shirt on, I think, and she danced around. She sang perfectly. I mean, her vocals, the sound was on the park stage, the sound was great, and her vocals were spot on, and it was proper, you know, nice, not too sheened, but nice, you know, nice clean pop, and it was great, and I really enjoyed it, and she performed really well. And she said in between songs that it had been pointed out to her that the size of the number of people that went to Glastonbury in the Glastonbury site was three times her hometown population. So, but she was charming. charming, and I really enjoyed it. I thought that was great. And then I tweeted that I was enjoying it, and a couple of people got in touch and said, oh, yes, she's really good. You should buy this EP. There's an album coming later this year, I think, which I will probably buy on the evidence of that, because I really enjoyed it. So I very much enjoyed Chic. In a way, I didn't watch Ed Sheeran, and I think you might have done, but I couldn't understand why Chic weren't headlining on the strength of that performance, but he proved me wrong.
Well, I must say, I much prefer the Glastonbury experience from my sofa. I mean, I've never roughed it. Last time I went in 2002, I stayed at the George and Pilgrim Hotel in Glastonbury High Street and commuted in and out every day.
And I've never been. I've been to Glastonbury, the town. I've stayed there before, but into the festival.
Well, I found that far more civilised. This year I enjoyed all the fuss some Egypts made on social media, believing Ed Sheeran was using backing tracks when it was obvious he was cleverly constructing loops on the fly. Yeah, but a lot of people at the time on Twitter and so on, oh look, you know, he's not even playing that guitar, and I can hear him singing, and he's, you know, his mouth isn't moving. Oh God, you know, get up to date, granddad. But actually, I enjoyed his set more than I thought I would. I've actually never seen him perform before. I've heard the odd track on the radio. But I did. The only trouble was I did find in a long set, I did find many of the songs became a bit indistinguishable after a while. They tended to blend in a bit. But I must say on that, I'm in a massive minority, because the shots of the crowd showed that you know, they were loving him. Yeah, Chic were great. Biffy Clyro kind of left me frowning, but I really did enjoy the Foo Fighters. They're a great stadium rock band, and so relaxed at being on stage. They just put all of their energy into their performance. Dave Grohl is a fantastic front man, and what, you know, they're just one of the great rock bands of all time. They were the highlights for me. Chic, were absolutely marvellous. And of course, I always forget how many hit songs.
Many tunes. And often that Nile Rodgers wrote for other people.
For other people, exactly. Yes. You know, we had Pointer Sisters and other hits sort of reigning in there. And he was able, it's always a sign that somebody's written an enormous number of hit songs when they can kind of throw them into a medley and just say, here's a medley of some of the hits I've made. Yeah,
And funnily enough, I was DJing last night and I played Upside Down by Diana Ross, and it's from the album Diana. All produced by Nile Rodgers.
Indeed. And I can see your point about why weren't they headlining, but it may be that even you at your youthful age, you know, a bit too old really, in the sense that, you know, we would love to see those sort of heritage acts headlining, but the youth, they wanted Ed Sheeran.
Yes, you say this, I'm going to throw something back at you. So my dad, bless him, he's 76, I think, and he'd be 77 next birthday, as my nan always used to say, for some reason, I don't understand why. Anyway, so I was speaking to him about it, and he said, everyone down the front's my age, and he's right. When I looked on the TV coverage, a vast majority of people there seem to be older rather than younger. I'm not entirely convinced it is completely a young man's festival. I say this, but someone who on the Friday afternoon of Glastonbury at work got our weekly, we have a weekly email around at work that a very cheery lady in one of our offices sends around. And often they have photographs of people in the firm and what they've been doing. And it's an excellent thing that's kind of bonds togetherness. And we were confronted with a picture of our 50-year-old managing partner at Glastonbury with a painted face. and that got me to thinking. And you know, I saw him last week, and he said, I didn't feel cool enough to be there, really. Why weren't you there? Which was very sweet. Bless him for thinking I was cool. But anyway, got me to thinking. And there's been a lot of chat about Jeremy Corbyn's appearance at Glastonbury and the fact that it is £238 a ticket. And, you know, is this just a kind of a white middle class Babylon, really? And I do wonder, when you look at the people in the crowd, they are ostensibly older. Maybe that's who Glastonbury should be for now, I must admit. But it does seem to be more middle class than ever to me. And it really is. You say, in a way, I think that she could well have headlined, because I didn't necessarily probably think that was a young person's audience.
Now, you may be thinking, listening to this, saying, well, why on earth haven't they mentioned Radiohead? But we'll be talking about Radiohead later.
We've saved that rail for the end.
That's right. It's fair to say their performance tended to split those watching into very pro or very perplexed. But more of that later. Justine Greening is Secretary of State for Education. Speaking at an event this week, she revealed that she'd failed to get a job after she left university because the potential employer believed she had committed a social faux pas at an Italian restaurant. Does social status still matter? That's next after, oh, this is just great, this is the Flirtations.
Great, you're right, Terence. That was the Flirtations and Nothing But a Heartache. A bit of a heartache for me because it was in the box of records that I lost last year. So I know, which I will never be over, clearly. But that's one of those kind of Northern Soul numbers, which I heard a couple of years ago. And I think I'd always been kind of vaguely aware. And I thought, oh, my goodness, this is an amazing tune. And I sometimes play it when out DJing because I'm always a bit nervous about playing it because I always wonder and think, you know, is anyone else going to know this? And it's funny, it's a song which I thought was quite obscure. It's always welcomed rapturously when I play it in the sort of Northern Soul section of my sets. People are very keen on it.
For my generation, they were all the Flirtations, they were always on the television in the 1970s.
Oh, really?
I thought they were a British group because they always popped up. They were like the series group guests on shows like, I don't know, like the Two Ronnies or the Cliff Richard show on a Saturday evening. But I discovered yesterday they came from South Carolina, but I think
there's a British team behind them.
Yeah, exactly.
Nothing But a Heartache was produced by Wayne Bickerton, and it was co-written by him and Tony Waddington, who were the duo that were later responsible for the Rubettes in the 1970s. So according to this, Nothing But a Heartache just missed the UK top 50. It got to 51. It was released in November 68, but in the Netherlands it reached the top 40, and it had a 14-week run on the Billboard Billboard Hot 100 in May 1969, which is interesting considering it peaked at 34 and it never actually reached the top 30. So to have a kind of a run in the middle-ish and not reach, in a way, it's quite impressive, really. So hats off to the sort of middle-of-the-road flirtations, because that song is a banger.
Rather dismally, I remember them being marketed in the 70s as the British Supremes, which I think did them more harm than good.
Well, quite, particularly because they weren't even British.
Exactly, yeah. Now, these days, I only wear a tie on two occasions. Funerals... And when I go to the cricket at Lord's, where if one is to be allowed into the pavilion in the long room, a jacket and tie are very much required.
Absolutely. And also, the atmosphere at Lord's is a bit funeral occasionally, isn't it?
Can often be so. There are exceptions. They're the exceptions. And increasingly... these sort of matters become less important. If I go to lunch at London's posh Wolseley, I would look out of place wearing a tie. And these days, more and more people seem to think that social mobility is outmoded. Most people these days describe themselves as middle class. Now, Jules, you were very much taken by this incident where Justine Greening believes she was denied a job by a strange event in an Italian restaurant.
Yes, very much so. And I found this really interesting. It was in the Daily Mail, which regular listeners know is not my constituency. But I discovered this because Victoria Corran subsequently wrote an article about it in The Observer, which is very much my constituency. So the story is that Justine Greening is the Secretary of State for Education. I believe she was state school educated. She's also openly gay, which I admire. A friend of a friend of mine went out with her many years ago and has nice things to say about her. She said that she went for an interview with an investment bank. She's comprehensive school education. She's from Rotherham. It's not clear when this took place, but looking at her kind of biography, I reckon this was probably about 20 years ago. So this was mid-90s. Well, I think things were still a bit different then. I think that to view this through the lens of now is not necessarily that helpful. She says that she had an interview at an investment bank. We won't speculate as to which one it is, but, you know, there are a few in London, aren't there? And she said the interview was fine. And then I got taken out to lunch by two of the junior managers in this investment bank, and they went to an Italian restaurant. And she said, I remember trying to work out whether I should order the meal in Italian or whether I should read the English translation underneath. In a split second, I decided I'm a non-pompous person. I will just read the English. I have a lot of sympathy with this. And I could tell with the body language that I had just failed a test. And she said, because I was meant to have had the confidence, apparently, I think, to have just said it in Italian. It wasn't that I didn't have that confidence. I absolutely had lots of confidence in the person, but I just had a different attitude as to how I felt it was appropriate to behave. She says, these are the small things which add up to big differences in terms of whether or not, in the end, people, I think, get opportunities. So I am coming at this from the perspective, I am younger than Justine Greening. I think I'm about 10 years younger than her. But I am also a woman from a state school educated background that has gone into a profession, you know, like a proper profession. I suppose some people would view it as that. And I often found myself being interviewed by men and, you know, going to things. Particularly the firm where I trained was insanely posh, and I often had to go to things, and there was a lot of which fork do I use and all that kind of stuff. And my boss was a bit of a horror, it has to be said. And I occasionally found myself being, you know, unconsciously judged on small things. And I, as a woman from a fairly working class background that has tried to make her way in a male-dominated profession, I have a lot of sympathy for Justine Greening. I don't think she's making it up. Stuff like that does happen. And in a way, I admire her for coming out and speaking. Well, if you pardon me, yes. Coming out and speaking about this. Because I think that, and I say this as someone who, I'm not deigning myself as an expert, but I think that if you are a young working to lower middle class woman, you have a different experience in the employment world to some other people.
I'm not saying she's making it up, but I just don't believe the situation was probably as straightforward as Justine Greening suggests, because no evidence is presented that she received feedback explaining that a reluctance to speak Italian.
She wouldn't have done, because these things are not these things are and maybe they didn't even realise. they were doing it. But I think the point that I'm making is that she might not have received feedback, but the very worst kind of prejudice, I think, in society, and the very hardest thing to kind of interact are, I suppose, when I was doing discrimination law, it was what was called indirect discrimination rather than direct discrimination. I know this isn't a, so an example of this is, for example, the fact that you're not saying I don't want women for this post, and you're not saying I don't want people who've born children for this post. What you're saying is I want someone for this post who is available from 7:30 in the morning until 6:30 in the evening. And what you're effectively saying, and you're not allowed to leave the office, and you're not, you know, there is no flexibility on that. And what you're effectively, you are indirectly discriminating against women because you're, what you're effectively saying is, you know, women are more likely not to be available at those times because they are likely to be carting kids off to school. And I think there is a subconscious class bias. I am going to get bolshy about this because, you know, I am, but I do feel that there is an awful lot of, there is a lot of class bias, I think, be it consciously or subconsciously, often unconsciously. I do think there is a class bias, particularly in places like investment banks and law and medicine and, you know, the old professions. And I do think, you know, as someone that went to a working class, went to a comprehensive school in a working class background, I am, to use that lovely common phrase, woke to this. And I love that usage of woke, Terence, to this. And I do feel that maybe things would be different now, but I feel that certainly 20 years ago, I do think that this is plausible. I love the current phrase, by the way, when people deny things as happening without actually wanting to say, no, it didn't happen. So I suspect they're not completely denying it. They always say, I didn't recognise this conversation. And I do recognise this experience of Justin Greening's. I do think it is plausible.
Okay. But Justin Greening, she's now 48 years old. So this would have happened, as you've said, 20, maybe 27, 28 years ago.
Yes, absolutely. If you say 25 years ago, okay, that makes it 1992.
I agree with you that the reverse would be possibly true now. But I don't disagree with anything you said about nobody should be discriminated against because they're a woman and because, you know, the employer might think, oh, they want to go home early because they might have children. That's ludicrous.
And also, no one should be discriminated against because they come from not the poshest of backgrounds.
Of course, but there could have been.
More often.
Okay, but there could have been. There could have been a multitude of other factors. Perhaps she came across as extremely nervous in that unnamed Italian restaurant. I'm guessing it wasn't Prezzo.
what does it matter? And this is where I find this frustrating. Why, you know, if the interview went really well and she's young and everyone's got to start somewhere, what the hell does going to an Italian restaurant have to do with anything?
Because maybe there were simply candidates who performed better at the interviews or when ordering the minestrone soup. But the thing is, obviously today you'd come across as the most tiresome buffoon if the menu in an Italian restaurant was in both English and Italian, and you tried, unless you're a fluent speaker of Italian, to try and bluff your way into ordering in Italian. I mean, the inherent danger would be coming across as a sort of Italian Manuel from Fawlty Towers. I'll have the spaghetti ciao, por favor, or something. It would be cringiness to the max. But I think it comes across in this piece and in this Victoria Corrin's kind of defence that it is all based on the premise that Justin Greening is assuming that that's why she didn't get the job, but we don't know why she didn't get the job.
Having said that, and I'm going to continue, I can't believe I'm in the situation where I'm defending the Conservative Secretary of State for Education, but I am, you know, I will continue to bang this drum because it's not fair to assume that someone is like someone else, but there are lots of parallels between myself and Justin Green, not just because we're, you know, gay women, but you know, maybe this is why I feel some kinship towards her, I don't know. But you know, both coming from, you know, my dad wasn't a steel worker and Justin Green, although my grandfather was a sheet metal worker, so I do have some sympathy with her here. And I, you know, I am going to defend her on this because when I've had interviews, I've always found to be quite thoughtful in temperament. And so I don't think it's reaching to think that the two of us might have some similarities about us in the way that we approach things and the way that we are. Obviously, politically, we might be different, but whenever I have interviews, and I have been for interviews, this sounds self-aggrandizing, it's not meant to be, but it was pointed out to me by my mother and by someone else, that actually I am a very good judge and a very objective and fair judge of how I perform at things. And I will come out and say sometimes I completely, you know, screwed that up, and it turns out, guess what, guys, I have. So I think that it is possible to be able to objectively judge someone's performance. And I had an incident where, and this is not quite the same thing, but I had an incident where another factor stopped me from getting the job after a good interview. I had an interview with a firm. I went in, there was the office manager and the then litigation partner there, and we had a great interview. It went really, really well. We had a great time, and I would have been employed in the litigation department on a short-term contract in the charts, so I would have then been offered a training place. I was working for another firm in the same town at the time, as I wasn't a qualified solicitor, but I was working doing what I do now, which is conveyancing. And I'd had a bit of a run-in with a partner at a law firm a couple of days ago. I hadn't been unpleasant, but basically what had happened was she had messed something up on a matter, and I had inadvertently, in trying to get it sorted out, shown her up. I'd shown her up to have made a mistake, and she was rather a pompous soul anyway. She's been retiring for the last 10 years. I think the Ravens will leave the tower before she goes. Anyway, we're still frosty on the telephone 10 years later, which is great. When women fall out, it's never improved. But anyway, so I'd had this interview with this chap, and it went really well, the two chaps, and they went, we'll be in touch. And I was sure that I'd got it. I was sure as eggs is eggs that I'd got that job. I had a phone call from the litigation partner the next day who said, can you still talk? And I did that kind of thing where you're pretending to talk to your mum as you walk past an office of people where you're working. And I managed to hide downstairs. And this man said, and some people might say it was this was unprofessional. I quite admired his honesty. He rung me up. I was about 22. He rung me up and he said, I've got to be honest with you. I wanted you for that job. You were my choice. You were far and away the best. It's been vetoed by another partner. Won't have you here. And I said, he said, I can't say who it is. And I said, you've just used a gender which has completely revealed this. And so the fact of the matter was that I was cost a job because of someone else's petty vendetta. And I'm happy to say this. I'm not naming the person, but I'm happy to say that. And I think that actually, although it's not a straightforward comparison with Justin Greening's experience, I think if you are a thoughtful and objective person that is able to judge your own performance, you know, either explicitly because someone's told you, or sometimes even implicitly, like this case with her, you know when there is f-wittery going on behind the scenes, frankly. I want to be very careful about how I address this, but I wonder if perhaps our slightly different backgrounds here, and the fact that my background is so similar to Justin Greening's, maybe this is why this has touched a nerve with me. I don't know.
Well, I was thinking after reading these pieces, we're more than 60 years on now from Nancy Mitford's marvellous essay on what is you and non-you.
Yes, I'd never read this, and thank you for introducing me to this. And I love the Mitfords. I thought this was great.
Yeah, you meaning upper class and non-you to be middle class. And I'm delighted to be holding up the end for all pompous poshos everywhere, as I really do refer to a looking glass rather than a mirror. I say, look at the looking glass. And I definitely use a napkin rather than a serviette. I mean, that actually makes me shudder, that one. And I'm certainly having my lunch at lunchtime and not having my dinner. So, one must have standards. But I do agree, though, that over the years, I hope we can agree on this, that in the 20-odd years since Justin Greening underwent that experience, yes, and indeed the years since you had your awful experience over 10 years ago.
That was about 10 years ago,
do hope that times have changed and we are more enlightened.
Yes, absolutely. I agree. And I'm going to bang the drum here. Difference between 1992, I do feel that the new Labour government really did, make the country a more tolerant, or rather the country became a more tolerant place during that time. Final point on you and non-new English. Maybe you can explain this to me, Terrence, given that you are something of an expert.
Well, of course.
Why is it that the upper class, that you are ill in bed, and if you're non-upper class, you say you're sick in bed. Yeah. Whereas if you're upper class, you say I was sick on the boat, and if you're lower class, you say I was ill on the boat. Why is it different ways round?
Well, these are the social niceties that one just has to
You haven't got one.
I haven't got one. I haven't got one. You saw through me immediately there.
I'm also enjoying the fact that I seem to be straddling genres. Mm. So I do eat my greens, which makes me lower class.
Oh, Lord.
I do speak about my grand's false teeth, which makes me upper class. I say that people have died, which makes me upper class.
Good, yes.
I say that someone is mental, which makes me lower class. I also have jam on my toast, which makes me upper class. And I say that someone is wealthy, which makes me lower class. I say, how do you do? Which makes me upper class, but I describe people as teachers, which makes me lower class.
Confusing.
What can I say, Terrence?
But wireless. You appear on the wireless rather than the radio, surely.
Well, I say radio.
Oh, Lord.
But that's because it's on the internet, Terrence. There are no wires.
As I discovered last weekend when I tweeted that watching Radiohead at Glastonbury was like attending the funeral of a serial killer, I discovered that their fans are very loyal and don't like snarky tweets. What's the big deal about Radiohead? That's next, right after Talking Heads.
Sometimes the world has a load of questions. Seems like the world knows nothing at all. The world is near, but it's out of reach. Some people touch it, but they can't hold on.
The world.
I'm not an enthusiastic dancer because I'm basically a bit too up myself by and large. But I am a huge, huge fan of dancing around to this. I'm hoping to investigate getting this on vinyl at some point. It's from the Superlative album Remain in Light by Talking Heads, and that was called The Great Curve. When I was first working, funny enough, in the town where the previous story took place, I was living with my parents at the time, and I was driving for about 20 minutes each day, 25 minutes, and then I would get the train for the last leg of the journey because of the way it all worked out. And Wax Factor in Brighton, excellent shop around that time, had a sale of their tapes where there was something like 20p each. They literally were trying to give them away. And I bought large amounts of the REM back catalogue at the time, which I still very much enjoy. And I also, the best 20 pence anybody will ever spend was on Remain in Light by Talking Heads. And I used to listen to that constantly to and from work each day. And what a great album it is.
And it's the album, actually, as probably many people know, that caused huge divisions in the band over songwriting credits, which of course we're going to speak of in another context shortly, and the album art, because Tina Weymouth devised the cover art and then David Byrne changed it, and they all agreed that they would share the songwriting royalties, and then David Byrne and Brian Eno changed it, and much unhappiness for everyone except David Byrne.
And that's what eventually caused the Talking Heads to split. And there was an excellent version at one point where three of them, I think, formed their own band without David Byrne and called The Heads, and their album was called No Talking, Just Heads.
Yes, exactly. And indeed, after this album, Brian Eno never produced them again, but I think the songwriting royalty wars continued. So.
Absolutely.
Now, I don't have any particular aversion to Radiohead. We barely know each other.
Well, that's very kind of you. Thank you.
Well, we haven't come across each other very much. It's just that Twitter, with its 140 character or fewer format, it's so convenient for the snappy, perhaps snarky one-liner. So when I did say listening to them was like attending the funeral of a serial killer, it was mainly for the lols rather than a rational review. But watching the same performance at Glastonbury, your Helen Lewis from Your New Statesman.
Yes, I'm a big fan of Helen and the publication.
Yes, as she wrote on Twitter, I quote, "If they don't want to put a melody in, that's their right, but no need to inflict it on the rest of us." And therein lies the issue with Radiohead for me. I'm not familiar with their work, but I watched about an hour or so and then switched off, I have to say, of them at Glastonbury. To me, it looked soulless, rather empty. Sounded a bit like a tuneless dirge. I must be missing something. I'm prepared to change my view. What is it with Radiohead, Jules? What am I missing?
Well, and actually, it's interesting. There were a lot of flame wars over social media about Radiohead that weekend. They seem to be immensely divisive. People seem to love them or loathe them. I suppose, really, I get a bit frustrated with people. I think you feel that when you were sort of critical about Radiohead, people kind of flame you and you think that's unjust. I mean, I have to say, if you are going to put slightly puerile comments like that up, then I'm afraid that you pretty much get what you deserve, I'm afraid. But when it comes to people being a bit more kind of measuring the pieces, like Helen Lewis and the idea that, you know, oh, it's tuneless. I often say to people, you know, my view on this is, to what extent are you being objective about this? There is a tune, it's just not one that you happen to like. Do you know what I mean? I feel that there are tunes to it, and I'm not, and I don't want to take the idea, oh, there are tunes, you just don't understand them, man, you don't get it. I don't want to take a superiority complex on this. I've got a pal of mine on Facebook who keeps saying, oh, well, I don't think they have tunes, because as a writer, I write music, and I feel like saying, yeah, reel off your hits for me, love, and then we'll chat, which is snarky, I know, in my own way. But I suppose I have a problem where people say that Radiohead are tuneless when I don't think they are. I think it's just not necessarily tunes that happen to catch your ear or ones that you happen to like. So I suppose that's my slightly kind of cross rebuttal. But in terms of why I love Radiohead, so they're a different band to the band they once were, and I think that is fair, and I can understand why people might have more interest in their earlier music than their later music. It's you know, the later stuff is not always very accessible. Having said that, I've stuck with Radiohead throughout, and I'm glad that I have done, because I find them a hugely rewarding band to listen to. I love how interesting they are, and I do admire them for the fact that, in a way, you might argue that they might be showing contempt by doing this on the main stage, but I thought their performance did have energy. I thought that it had drama to it. I thought the lighting was fantastic, and I thought it was really well staged. Mm. And I liked the idea that they don't necessarily do what they're meant to, and they plough their own furrow. And it's music that I think rewards repeated listening, and I find it increasingly frustrating that we live in a world where everything has to be instant and nobody gives anything a chance. And we've talked about the kind of idea of slowness and slow TV previously, haven't we? And you know, I thought they were incredibly atmospheric, and obviously I knew most of the music, so I watched it, you know, looking forward. And I was interested that they did a lot of hits at the end, and they did a, you know, they did Creep, which I thought was nice, and I like the fact that they have an atmosphere about them, and that they build things up. And interesting, I was talking to my two dear friends of mine, and they were watching Radiohead, and she said, "I can tell this is brilliant. I don't really like it. It's not to my taste, but I can tell this is very, very well crafted, and I can tell that this has a huge amount of integrity to it, and that they mean what they're doing, and that is great. It's just not my thing." And actually, I much prefer people that say that rather than saying, "Oh, this has got no tune." I find it to be a bit, because, you know, I there are some music that I hear and I think, "Oh, this is not, you know, this is a bit dirgy," but I'll just say it's not to my taste, because someone else, you know, one man's trash is another man's treasure. Someone else can hear something different in this, and that doesn't make them better. It's not, and I think that Radiohead fans do fall into this kind of, "Oh, well, you just, you know, it's not my fault you're not getting this and you don't understand this." I don't want to put a value judgment to that, but some people hear different things, and I think that, you know, I love Radiohead, and I think that they are a band that have continued to achieve success, perhaps not to the level of the Benz and OK Computer, but they continue to sell records, they continue to sell out tours, and there are a lot of people who genuinely love them. And I like the fact that they play music and the lyrics are slightly you know, skew if, and they make some political statements, and they're a band for the times, I think. And we're living in such an uncertain time in many ways, both in this country and around the world. And I liked the idea that Radiohead's music often strikes notes of uncertainty rather than certainty, I think. And, you know, there is a bit of murk here and there. And I felt like I did when I watched PJ Harvey last year. And I know I love these two bands anyway, but I felt when she played last year during Brexit weekend, the weekend just after the referendum, she kind of hit on a moment in time, I felt. And I think in a way Radiohead are kind of doing the same thing, really. And I like they kind of have accidentally captured the zeitgeist, really, without meaning to. And you know, and again, the Foo Fighters, I didn't enjoy the Foo Fighters at all. I watched 45 minutes of the Foo Fighters and then turned it off because I thought it was, I have to say, I thought it was a bit too noisy for me. Now, I don't want to say it was a noisy racket, because it wasn't. They were playing tunes, some of which I knew, and so I'm not going to say, "Oh, this is just noise, it's just a racket, I'm turning it off." It was, you know, it was too loud for me. But having said that, that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, that I'm right in that I think it's a tuneless racket. It just wasn't, you know, it just wasn't as interesting to me as other things. And so I think, you know, I don't want everyone to say, "Oh, you must like Radiohead," because I think that's wrong. But I am a defender of Radiohead, because I do think they're doing something very interesting that I don't feel that many other artists are.
I suppose they have elements in common with my hero, Todd Rundgren, in that they never seem to stick with a successful format, and it's rather brave of them, I suppose, in a musical sense, to keep reinventing themselves and to absorb new ways of creating their sound. I noticed, we alluded to this much, much earlier, I noticed that they share all the songwriting royalties as equal partners, and this often holds the key to keeping bands together, as the financial rewards are then shared equally. Coldplay and U2 do the same, and are also, you know, they're notable, aren't they, for keeping the same members throughout. And that royalty sharing must be the key to quelling jealousy. It must be galling to see the singer and the guitarist buying their farms in the Cotswolds while the drummer is still living with his mum in Ruislip. So, you know, I accept that, you know, they've probably got their hearts in the right place, and they obviously work well together, and they must, well, clearly you must get on well together to stick together all that length of time. So I must try harder with Radiohead. I do accept that.
I don't want you to feel that you have to. And but I think, yeah, I had a friend of mine around for lunch the other day, and she said that it's very telling that they've been together. I mean, two of them are brothers, but they've been together. But then look at the Gallagher brothers. That doesn't always necessarily work. And they've been together since the late 80s, 88, I think. They formed 89. They were all at school together. And I think it's great that they've stayed together for 30 years. And it was actually, there was a really interesting oral history in the Rolling Stone, I think, to do with OK Computer, which is 20 years old this year. And that's partly why they were headlining, I think, because it was you know, it's been re-released. My box set's coming next week. I'm very excited. We can talk about that. I'll do an unboxing with you on the podcast.
Something to look forward to. And
Hoco Computer, I don't think Tom York ever truly recovered from it. And I don't mean that everything he's done since has not been as good. But that and the resultant tour, which actually a film was made about how miserable the tour was, called Meeting People is Easy, which is quite an interesting watch. You might find yourself a bit worn out by middle-class people whinging, but it was quite good. And in a way, Tom York completely lost his bearings, I think, afterwards, and had to spend 18 months kind of going away and recovering, and decided, in order to try and move on from this enormous experience, that he wanted just everything to be synths, really, and that he wanted, you know, Kid A was a real electro direction, and it was incredibly alienating for the rest of the band, who were a rock band, and did, I know OK Computer was a bit different, but they did not know what to do. And in a way, you know, Radiohead's biggest achievement, I think, was coming through the other side of that time, really, because I think everyone in the band kind of reconvened to go back to do, you know, to do some more recording. And Tom York kind of turned up and just went, so we're going to use all these synthesizers and we're going to use these computers. And everyone went, kind of, what? You know, I'm a guitarist. What are you doing? And Ed O'Brien wrote this very honest diary. Radiohead were very early adopters of the internet. They had a website called Waste, which I think is still available. I think I did buy my box set through them. They used to have some excellent online merchandising. And Ed wrote this diary, this studio diary, and there's a particularly good bit where he realizes that they've spent 366 consecutive days recording a song which has turned out to be a B-side. But it's excellent. But it really was. It was a kind of very telling that Kid A had a really difficult birth, if you pardon the pun. It was really, there were times when I was reading his diary on my parents' dial-up connection in the late 90s. Mm. I had to find myself thinking, are they going to split up? Because it read, like, and I wonder if it's still available. I might try and have a dig and see if I can still find it online, because it was really interesting. And there are so many bands around that time who were sort of, you know, the laddie ed tail end of Britpop, who would never have had the honesty and the openness to do that, really. So that's what I find. I find Radiohead to be very thoughtful, and that interests me a great deal. The older I get, the more I think want things to be thoughtful rather than certain.
I would like to see that documentary that you talk about, because I love behind-the-scenes documentary.
Yes, it's easily attainable on DVD, and I suspect if you dig on the YouTube, you might find parts there as well.
What did you say it was called?
Meeting People is Easy. I think it's directed by a guy called Grant G, I think.
Okay, I've made a note. Now, here's the thing. Assuming you're not appearing with Jeremy Corbyn anywhere this week, where might your public find you?
Well, yes, I am the Stormzy of my local postcode. Well, there was a much disappointment by the lack of Stormzy, by the way.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine.
Yes, never mind. I was out and about DJing last minute last night. That was a lot of fun. This week, I think I'm doing Indie Wonderland on Barricade Radio from 8 until 10 p.m. And that is indie, alt rock and miscellaneous. So that's on barricaderadio.com. And that's
Wednesday?
Yes, Wednesday.
At 8 p.m.
At 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. or else. And that's pretty much it this week.
Okay, well, huge thanks to executive producer Rona, who continues to be working with Kathy Burke on a fundraising plan for the Grenfell
this
Towers.
Yes, this is so good. This is, you know, big ups to Rona,
absolutely,
as always.
Absolutely, yeah. Now, we're playing out with a Radiohead track. I played this yesterday. First time I heard it, rather liked it.
Well, yes. Well, they played it in their set, you see, and this is where
I come unstuck.
Well, slightly. It was the third song in, I think, of their set, and it was the one that really started to make me think that this set was going to be really good and I was going to really enjoy it. It's from their most recent album, which is called A Moonshape Pool, and it's spelt slightly wrong. And I think regular listeners know my frustration when people get spelling wrong. They've left the L off the end of full, so it's F-U-L, which is just irritating anyway, and pretentious as some might say Radiohead are. But they played this third in, and it starts off quite mildly, and then it kind of builds and builds and builds. And I felt particularly lyrically this was hugely relevant to the time that we're living in at the moment. And I think there was a barbed comment about Theresa May around the time they played this, and I just love this. And I think that this is a real example of, if you listen closely to Radiohead, they really reward that listening. And I thought this was fantastic. This is Radiohead, and this is Full Stop.
You have been listening to a DACM Media production.